So apparently, here we are, the end of January, dead of winter. It must be a good day to be talking about agriculture. Because in addition to the sermonette that we had, today what I'd like to do is go through the Bible. Because as you go through the Bible, you'll see a lot of references to agriculture. God's holy days are centered around the two harvest seasons. You see a lot of references in the parables and different analogies. But most of us don't have a farming background. So are we getting as much out of these references as we possibly could? So today what I'd like to do is go through the agricultural year that is present in Israel, talk about various major elements of that, and see how they are being used in the spiritual references. So what are some of the aspects of the Bible farming year that can help us gain a better understanding of spiritual lessons that the Bible presents to us? Well, first off, let's define what is the agriculture year. Because there are a lot of different ways of defining years. Here in the United States, we have our calendar year starts in January, ends in December. But at the same time, our government operates on a fiscal year that starts October 1st, goes through to the end of the next September. In the Bible, we have the sacred year. But we also have an agricultural year that's referenced in the Bible. Now, the agriculture year in Israel began after the feast days in the autumn and continued through the end of the full cycle of the annual feasts that were followed there. We see references to the end of the year, and that's talking about the agriculture year. We see references to that in Exodus. Let's go ahead and take a look at that. Exodus chapter 23. And we'll look at verses 14 through 16. Exodus 23, verses 14 through 16. Three times you shall keep a feast to me in the year. You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. You shall eat unleavened bread 7 days, as I commanded you, at the time appointed in the month of Abib. For in it you came out of Egypt, none shall appear before me empty. And the feast of harvest, the firstfruits of your labors, which you have sown in the field, and the feast of ingathering at the end of the year, when you have gathered the fruit in your labors from the field. So what does it mean here when you see this phrase, at the end of the year? Because obviously this isn't talking about the sacred year, because we're only just in the seventh month. There are still 5, and some years 6 more months to go. So it's not talking about the end of the year of the sacred calendar. It's talking about some other year. And what it's talking about is the end of the agricultural year. So what we see here, there is a 12-month period between the beginning of the agricultural preparations of the harvest to the time when that grows, and then eventually it's all harvested. Now, there are some key events as we look at this 12-month period in the agriculture year. It starts after the feast is over. Some of those key events we'll talk about here. The first one is rainfall. Now, obviously, when it comes to agriculture, rainfall is a key event. But it is more so from a biblical perspective than what we might think. Rainfall is a critical element in the agriculture cycle, and it was typically the first indication that a new agricultural year was starting. Why is that? Well, two things we want to take a look at. Rainfall in Israel is absolutely vital for providing water, supplying water to the land. Why is it considered the start of the agricultural year? We're used to 4 seasons here, right? And we've got precipitation every season Even down in Alabama, we get snow. But in Israel, there are only two seasons. There's the wet season, and there's the dry season. Each one is 6 months long. So, right after the feast is when the 6 month period of the dry season is starting to end. Well, think about what that does to the soil. Think about what that does to the land. It's hard. It's dry. You can't plant anything in that soil. You can't even work the soil because there's been no rain for 6 months. It was different than what the Israelites were used to when they're in Egypt. Let's take a look at what God had to say about that, what he told them concerning the land they were coming into. We'll take a look here in Deuteronomy chapter 11 and verses 10 and 11. This is what God told them about the land they're going to be going to. Deuteronomy chapter 11, verses 10 and 11. For the land which you go to possess is not like the land of Egypt from which you've come, where you sowed your seed and watered it by foot as a vegetable garden. But the land which you cross over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water from the rain of heaven. See, the land is not like it was in Egypt. In Egypt, they had the Nile River. And they had to manually irrigate their fields, various mechanisms that they would draw the water out of the Nile, put it into the different channels, and water the fields. That wasn't going to be the case in the land they're going to. That land required rain. So Israel depended on the rainfall. And it's absolutely necessary to moisten the soil, to replenish the pools and the streams, and to water the crops. Because they had no other way to do that. The only river they had was way over on the eastern border. That was the Jordan River. They didn't have any lakes within their countryside. They had little pools, maybe streams and stuff like that. But there's no major freshwater source. They relied on the rain. Secondly, they also knew that rainfall depended on God. There are a lot of verses, as you can go through the Bible and talk about the rainfall here, that tell us that God is in control of the rainfall. Now, modern day scoffers will say, he's not responsible for that. It's just part of the normal water cycle and stuff like that. But a couple things you wanted to consider about this. Yeah, maybe it's part of the normal water cycle. But who created the science which causes the water cycle? It was God. He's the one who set that up. He's the one who put that in place. And then secondly, when necessary, and we see this again and again in the Bible, when necessary, God can supernaturally intercede to change what might normally occur in the water cycle. And there are verses that tell us this. While we're still here in Deuteronomy chapter 11, let's take a look at one of those. Deuteronomy chapter 11, and this time verses 13 through 17. What does God say here? And it shall be that if you earnestly obey my commandments, which I command you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, then I will give you the rain for your land in its season, the early rain and the latter rain, that you may gather in your grain, your new wine, your oil, and I will send grass in your fields for your livestock, that you may eat and be filled. But take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be deceived and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. Lest the Lord's anger be aroused against you and he shut up the heavens so that there be no rain and the land yield no produce and you perish quickly from the good land which the Lord is giving you. God clearly was in control of the rain, and he can use it to bless his people who are faithfully following him, or to curse those who do not follow him. So let's dig a little bit more into the rainfall. We have three different sections of rain. The first one here, the early rains. So sometimes you'll see it early rain, sometimes you'll see it referred to as the former rains. But shortly after the seventh month of the sacred year, after the Feast of Tabernacles is over, there's a change in the prevailing winds. They start to shift south and southwest, and now the winds are coming across the Mediterranean. There's all that moisture in the air. So as the winds carry that air and that moisture, it starts to rain. And it's soft rain at first. It starts out lightly, but gradually. And it increases over the next few weeks. Why were these rains essential? Well, again, we talked about how hard that soil was. Well, the early rains, when they would start falling, would help soften the soil to provide a little bit of moisture. And so now they can get in and start to plow the soil. And as they get the soil plowed, then they can start planting the grain. So it's absolutely critical that you get these early rains to soften up the soil, start putting that moisture back into the dirt so they can plant their crops. It's interesting. Take a look with me over at Psalm 65 and verses 9 and 10. Gives an idea of what these early rains, these softer rains, do for the land. Psalm 65 and verses 9 and 10. These rains signaled to the farmers it's time to start plowing. It's the beginning of the agricultural year. Psalm 65 verses 9 through 10. You visit the earth and water it. You greatly enrich it. The river of God is full of water. You provide their grain, for so you have prepared it. You water its ridges abundantly. You settle its furrows. You make it soft with showers. You bless its growth. That's what God does for the land as these early rains start to fall. So, during this period of time, during early rains, we were talking about plowing. The soil in the fields had to be plowed so that the seeds would have a suitable soil to sprout in, to allow them to grow, to allow the roots to take hold. So what did they use as a plow? Now, again, we're used to something that's drastically different. You see these tractors with these huge, we used to call them seven-bottom plows, where the tractor would pull it through and it would just dig into the soil, turn it over, and then come through later and disc it. This is not what they used in Israel. We would actually consider what they used as plows to be very primitive. The plow was constructed in the following manner. There was the main frame, and it was two beams. At the front of the two beams, that's where it would hook on to the yoke that was across the oxen. So as you come to the back, there's a cross piece that would join the back ends of that frame. Now, the plow itself connected to this cross piece at the back end of the plow. It was a long, pointed pole with a handle on top that you could hold and press down and grip. Sometimes, if they could afford it, they would put metal at the pointed tip of the plow to make it sturdier, to make it be able to dig into the soil more readily. And really, it didn't really turn over the soil. It just scratched the surface. It made enough of a little furrow, like an inch or so deep, where there would be space for the seed to fall. And the plow was made in such a way that it really didn't take that much effort to convert the plow into a sword or vice versa. And you'll see references to that in Joel and Isaiah, where it's talking about, you know, convert your plows to swords, or you convert your swords to plowshares. That's what it's talking about. It's about this long pointed pole with this handle on the end. Now, in addition to that, farmers also use a long, sturdy, pointed wooden rod as a goad. Told you we're going to be talking about this a lot today. We turned to Acts 9 earlier, and Jesus said, "Is it hard for you to kick against the goads?" Well, why that particular phrasing? Well, what's happening here is that when the farmer's trying to get the ox to move so he can get that plow down in the soil and stuff, if the ox didn't want to move, he couldn't exactly just say, "Hey, you up there, get going." No, he had this goad here, and it was pointed on the end, and he'd use that to poke at the ox. So he's holding that in one hand, he's holding the plow in the other hand, he's got the reins and stuff to try to keep the plow steady. But if the ox didn't want to move, what would it do? It would kick with its back leg. Well, when it kicked, boom, it's kicking up against that sharp pointed end, and that's painful. And pretty soon, the ox figures out, this isn't doing me any good, so it goes the direction that it's being guided. This is the same thing that is referred to here in Paul's situation. Whatever it was that Christ was doing, what was goading him, the net effect is that Christ is saying to him, "I want you to go in a particular direction." He was fighting against it, and finally it got to be too painful. He said, "Okay, I'll submit. What do you want me to do?" That's referencing that long, pointy stick that farmers would use as they're plowing their fields. Now, when it came to using the plow, we're talking hard work here, because handling the animals, the plow, and the goads, so that they worked together properly to plow the field, took focused attention and an effort to keep the plow in the soil. Because you think about it, you've got soil here, and you're trying to dig into it. Well, it's going to push back. So as a farmer, you have to constantly be pushing on the plow so it stays in the soil. You also have to make sure that you're keeping it in the right direction and not doing this, because otherwise your furrows are going to be all back and forth. So it was a difficult task to do the job right. And Jesus made a reference to this. Let me read to you the reference that he made in Luke chapter 9 and verse 62. Luke 9:62 refers back to what the farmer was having to do here. Luke 9:62, "But Jesus said to him, 'No one, having put his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom.'" Well, why is that a problem? Well, the farmer literally had to put his hand to the plow. He had to force it. He had to put pressure on that. He had to guide it. And he had to keep focused to where he was going and the job that was to be done. One hand was placed on the top, keep the pressure there, and make sure that the soil was tilled in an even fashion. The other hand was holding the goad to make sure the oxen would keep going in the right direction. So think about this. Why does the farmer need to plow? Well, he's tilling his field because he's looking forward to new life and growth, ultimately resulting in a harvest that produces a crop that is many, many times greater than what he's planting. Plowing is only the first step. It's not the only thing that he has to do. And we see a reference to that in Isaiah. Let's turn there. Isaiah chapter 28 and verses 24 and 25. Isaiah 28, verses 24 and 25. Does the plowman keep plowing all day to sow? Does he keep turning his soil and breaking the clods? Well, the answer to that is no. Verse 25, when he's leveled his surface, does he not sow the black cumin and scatter the cumin, plant the wheat and rows and the barley in the appointed place and the spelt in his place? The farmer is looking to the future. That's why he's plowing, to plant something that's going to grow. We too are looking to the future in hope. Like the farmer who hopes for an excellent crop, we look forward in hope to the kingdom of God. And if we're to achieve that goal, we must diligently prepare ourselves in a manner similar to the diligence that the farmer must have when he's plowing his field. Number one, we have to keep our focus. You see, plowing here is used as a symbol for our seeking the kingdom of God, and each requires a commitment, a dedicated effort, and a desire to move forward and not look back. We need to keep our focus in looking forward. Consider what Paul wrote in Philippians in chapter 3. Let me just read that part to you, Philippians 3 and sections of verse 12 and 13. Not that I have already attained or am already perfected, but I press on. It's like the farmer with his hand on that plow. He's pressing on. He's moving forward. Forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forward to those things which are ahead. He's got a goal in mind. And Jesus warned about looking back. And why is that a problem? Well, again, plowing a field is hard. And what happens, you know, you're pushing on this plow, you're trying to guide the oxen and stuff. What happens when you're looking back? You look back, chances are pretty good your arm's going to move, isn't it? So now your furrows are all over the place. Looking back causes a diversion from the direction that's needed to keep the oxen moving. Or, if you've stopped them so you can look back, now you're not getting your work done. Looking back can lead to complacency. That's another problem with looking back. You stop and think, oh, look what I've accomplished. And it leads to a sense of self-satisfaction. Look what I've managed here. Look how far I've come. Instead of thinking, yeah, I've managed a lot here, but there's still more to be done to complete the task that's ahead of me. And another thing is looking back can lead to a desire to go to things how they were before. And that's not what we want to do. We're looking forward to the kingdom of God. We're not looking back behind us to the life that we're called from. So once the plowing is done, we see that there are numerous references that speak of sowing, growing, and harvesting the barley and wheat, which are known as the first fruits. Now, these accounts, talking about the sowing and growing and stuff, they have particular significance for each of us because we are being called to be the first fruits. Once the field had been plowed, it had to be sown with grain. Now, again, we don't have these, they didn't have these big planters where they pull along and they just drill the grain right into the soil. What they would do is they'd have a sack of the grain hanging on their shoulders and stuff like that. they'd scoop their hand in and broadcast the seed across the field. But what would happen with broadcasting the seed like that? It wasn't always the perfect, best way of doing things, but the way they had it. But there were some potential problems where the seed wouldn't come to anything. Let me read to you from Luke chapter 6 and verse 1. And this always seemed odd to me, having grown up in a farming area, to try to imagine, what? What's this talking about? Luke 6, verse 1. Now it happened on the second Sabbath, after the first, that he went through the grain fields, and his disciples plucked the grains of heads of grain and ate them, rubbing them in their hands. Why are they walking through the middle of this field? That seems odd. But there was this road there. Well, it wasn't really a road. It's more actually like a footpath. Because you see, prior to the time that the Romans came into Israel, there were no major roads. There were just these footpaths getting from one place to the other. And because people constantly use the same path over and over and over, that soil will get so packed down. As the farmer knew, it's not going to do any good to try to plow that. There's no way I can scratch that soil. And so when you see the parable of the seed that falls on the wayside, that's what it's talking about. It's just talking about this footpath that goes through the field. And that path would come up right to the edge of the field. So you can see when you're broadcasting the seed, some of it's going to fall on the path, while some of it stays in the field. The other thing that always seemed odd to me is thorns in the field? Wait, aren't those just noxious weeds? Can't they get rid of those? Why is Jesus talking about seed falling among the thorns? Well, actually, what these thorns were, they frequently grew at the edge of the fields, and they were bushy, woody plants, and they're deliberately kept there. Because in the summertime, when the shepherds were out with their flocks, at nighttime, they can cut some of these thorns and use that as kindling for their fires to stay warm and cook their food and stuff. So they kept the thorns there for a reason. They would also use thorns sometimes to build a slight corral to help protect their sheep and stuff. So that's why there were thorns right at the edge of the field. Matter of fact, back in Exodus, let me just make a reference to it. Exodus 22, verse 6, talks about this practice of using the thorn bushes for fires and gives instructions. If a fire breaks out and catches in the thorns, then God gives instructions for this. That's why the thorns are there. So we've had the lighter rains, the former rains. We've gotten the plowing done. We've gotten the seed planted. Then we get to what we call mid-December. And now is what we start in considered as the heavy rains. Because once again, we've got this shift of weather patterns. And now the wind has shifted to where prevailing winds are coming out of the north. And it's bringing rain. But what happens is, as these winds are coming south, there frequently are high-pressure tropical fronts sitting over Africa, which blocks the movement of the rain. So when it comes, it just rains and rains and rains. Days on end, it'll rain. And it's not this nice, warm, balmy rain. It's cold. It's wet. In some years, it actually gets cold enough where they've recorded snowfall in Jerusalem and even in Cairo and Egypt during this time frame. As it says in Proverbs chapter 25 and verse 23, let me just read that. The north wind brings forth rain and a backbiting tongue and angry countenance. Let's take a look at that, where these rains are referred to. Let's turn back to Ezra, chapter 10. And first we'll look at verse 9. Ezra, chapter 10, and verse 9. So all the men of Judah and Benjamin gathered at Jerusalem within 3 days. It was the 9th month, on the 20th of the month. And all the people sat in the open square of the house of God, trembling because of this matter and because of heavy rain. Let's drop down to verse 12 and 13. Ezra chapter 10, verses 12 and 13. Then all the assembly answered and said with a loud voice, "Yes, as you have said, so we must do. But there are many people, and it's the season for heavy rain, and we're not able to stand outside. Nor is this the work of 1 or 2 days, for there are many of us who have transgressed in this manner." The 20th day of the 9th month corresponds to late December in the Roman calendar. The people were trembling because, well, they had the realization that they had violated God's commands, but also they're trembling because they're freezing cold. They're standing out there in this wet, heavy, cold rain. These rain systems are so miserable that no respectable shepherd is going to keep his flocks out in the pasture during this mid-late December. Oh, guess what? This is yet another indication that Jesus Christ was not born in late December. Because when he was born, the shepherds were out in the pastures. If they'd been out here in December, their sheep would be dead. But there's a huge benefit that comes from these heavy rains. The water from these rains is what provides the primary moisture for the crops, particularly the grains. Without those rains, the grains couldn't grow, and there'd be no crop to harvest. But in addition to that, they were crucial for supplying and replenishing the water supply for Israel. It would fill the streams. It would fill the pools all around the country, which makes the water available for the rest of the year. Let me read to you Amos chapter 4 and verse 7. Amos 4, verse 7, talking about the period of time here for the heavy rains. "I also withheld rain from you when there were still 3 months to the harvest. I made it rain on one city. I withheld rain from another city. One part was rained upon, and where it did not rain, the part withered." So we see how important it was that we had this heavy rainfall to supply the water for the entire land for all the rest of the year. As the heavy rains begin to taper off, this is beginning sometime during the month of February, we now get to the third division of the rainy season. And that's referred to in the Bible as the latter rains. And usually the latter rains started falling in early March. Now, it wasn't as heavy as the heavy rains that just ended, but they were still critical. It still played an important role because what the water from the latter rains would do is that the barley would start to mature in the latter part of March, so it needed this additional moisture to allow the grain to mature. And then the wheat itself, it's forming grain heads, so those heads had to have this extra moisture to develop and then for them to mature about 4 weeks later. Latter rains also provided the needed moisture for the pastures. When what we read earlier, God said, "I provide the green grass for your livestock." That's what it's talking about. These rains provide enough moisture for the land in the pasture areas where the grass could start growing and start greening up. And as you look through the Bible, you'll see a lot of references to latter rains. But that now brings us up to
the grain harvest, a very significant part of the agricultural year.
So as the latter rains were still coming down, starting to slowly taper off, is when the farmers would begin to harvest the grain. Now, the wave sheaf offering that was presented during the days of unleavened bread signaled that the first fruits could begin to be used, the harvesting, the eating of it, and so forth. The barley was harvested first, and then the wheat harvest started about a month later. So the combined harvest of the two grains, the first fruits, would take about 7 weeks. It's time from the wave sheaf offering to Pentecost. Because the barley matures sooner than wheat, it's harvested, and a lot of it was actually brought in from the field before most of the wheat harvested even started. What does it mean for us that the first fruits are brought out of the field? Well, as we look at the explanation for the parable of the wheat and tares, let me read that to you. When Jesus was asked by his disciples, "We don't understand what you just said. Can you explain it to us?" In Matthew 13, in verses 36 to 38, Jesus sent the multitude away and went into the house, and his disciples came to him saying, "Explain to us the parable of the tares of the field." And he answered and said to them, "He who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world. And the good seeds are the sons of the kingdom, but the tares are the sons of the wicked one." So bringing the first fruits in from the field represents the varying times that the spiritual first fruits are removed from this world. It happens over a longer period of time. It doesn't happen all at once. The removal from the field doesn't instantly bring forth a new life within the grain. And bringing them out of the field doesn't necessarily represent the time that they were resurrected to spirit beings. When you stop and think about it, there are a number of first fruits who have already died. They're already brought out of the fruit, but they haven't been resurrected yet. They're waiting for that time when Jesus Christ returns. So what does it take to bring the first fruits in from the field? What does it take? Why does it take so much time to harvest that grain? Well, we kind of lose track of that because when we look at our combines that we're using modern day, the whole process is done right there in the one machine. So we don't really see what all is going on. There are different stages for harvesting the grain. The first one is cutting the grain. You got the stalks, and then right at the top of the stalks, you got the grain heads. Now, they had to use little hand sickles, so you can imagine the amount of work, back-breaking work, that it would take to go in and harvest these fields. So what they would do, because it took a longer time to harvest, they didn't wait until there were these nice amber waves of grain out there. If they did that, the majority of the crop would rot because it takes too much time to harvest it. But what they would do is they would look for a particular transition phase. And they knew once the grain had reached this stage, even though it wasn't fully ripe yet, they could cut the stalks and the grain could still mature. What was that stage? So when the grain heads changed from a purely green color to having this whitish hue. And sometime this summer, if you happen to go by a field of wheat or something like it, and it's still green, a certain time of year, you can see that the grain heads are actually whitish colored. And Jesus referred to that in John chapter 4, verse 35. What did he say? In John chapter 4, verse 35, Jesus said, Do you not say there are still 4 months and then comes the harvest? But I say to you, lift up your eyes and look at the fields, for they are already white for harvest. The grain heads had gotten this white color. It's ready for harvest. So what they would do is, as they were cutting the stalks, they would gather them up in sheaves. And we saw, like in Joseph's dream, how his brother's sheaves bowed down to him. Well, this is what he's talking about, the sheaves of cut grain stalks. And they would stack them out in the field in a kind of a conical structure, so that even if they got rained on, the moisture would just drain down. It wouldn't cause the grain to rot. So as it's standing there, it could still mature. And so they'd be harvesting the fields. They would stack them out there, letting it mature while they're continuing to harvest and cut the other fields. And once that was done, once the grain matured enough there in the field, then they'd move on to the next step, and that's the threshing process. They'd bring the sheaves into the threshing floor. Now, what does that mean? Well, threshing is a process of detaching the grain from the stalks, because you're obviously not going to eat the stalks. Stalks were used later as straw, but the main focus of the threshing was to gather the grain. Now, the threshing floor could be an actual wooden structure, but more often than not, what they did is they cleared off an area of soil, they packed it down, they swept it off to minimize the amount of dirt and rocks and stuff that can get in with the grain, and then they would thresh the grain there. And there are different ways of doing that. One, they could beat the stalks with this big heavy flail, which is basically a large flexible stick, and you're standing there, whack, 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 trying to beat the grain's head off of the stalks. We see a reference to that. I'll just give you the verse reference in Ruth 2, verse 17. Talks about Ruth. After she was gleaning, she did threshing, and that's what she was doing. But that was hard work. And it wasn't economical to try to do that for a large field. Instead, what they would do is they would have oxen. They'd bring the grain stalks into the threshing floor, and then they'd have oxen walking around. And you remember, we can eat them because oxen have split cloven hooves. So as they're walking across the grain, those hooves would start to separate the grain from the stalks. And I keep doing that, keep doing that. A third way is they would still use the oxen to trample the stalks, but they'd build what's called a threshing sled, about 3 feet wide, about 6 feet long. You'd drive sharp stones down into it. You hook that up to your oxen. So the oxen are threshing. They're pulling the sled. A man would stand on the sled to keep weight to it, and as that goes around, that sled is also cutting the grains from the stalk. To give you an idea of how this threshing sled treated, so to speak, the stalks, the Roman version of it was called a tribulum, which has as its root word the same word that gives us our word, tribulation. Now, Isaiah talks about this threshing process. Let's take a look at that. Isaiah 41, verse 15. Isaiah 41, verse 15. Behold, I will make you into a new threshing sledge with sharp teeth. And you shall thresh the mountains and beat them with small, and make the hills like chaff. So that was the threshing, to separate the grain from the stalks. Now we got the next step, and that's the winnowing process. Because you still have the grain, the chaff,
the stalks of the plant is still all together. You have to separate it now. And so they'd use what's called a winnowing fan or a winnowing fork, and they go in there and scoop it up and toss it up in the air. And they'd usually do this in the evening, because what would happen here is as they tossed it up in the air, the wind would catch the chaff and the straw, because it's pretty lightweight. It would blow it off to the side, whereas the grain was still heavy. It would just fall right back down. So you keep doing that repeatedly, letting the wind blow it away, and keeping your grain down here at the bottom. We see a reference to this when Jesus Christ returns. He's pictured as winnowing the church to separate those who are actually his first fruits from those who actually are not. We see John the Baptist talking about that. Let's take a look at that in Luke chapter 3 and verse 16 and 17. What does John say here? Luke chapter 3, verses 16 and 17. John answers and saying to all, I indeed baptize you with water, but one mightier than I is coming, whose sandal strap I am not worthy to loose. He will baptize you with the Holy Spirit and fire. His winnowing fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly clean out his threshing floor and gather the wheat into his barn, but the chaff he will burn with unquenchable fire. John's talking about the first fruits here, the church. Jesus Christ is going to have to make a separation when he returns. Once the winnowing is done, now you've got the final step. That's the sifting. And usually what would happen is they had big, wide baskets, fairly shallow. You scoop up the grain, and you kind of do this, and you sort through. It's usually the women who do this. Because what they're looking for is, if you got little stones, well, obviously you don't want stones in your grain, because you're going to have to send your grain through your grinder, and the stone's not good for your grinder. But there are also the tares. As we mentioned in the wheat and the tares parable, that was darnel, sometimes called false wheat. But the difference is that their grain was dark, as opposed to being light like the wheat is. You don't want that in there, because if you consume too much of it, it can lead to nausea, vomiting, illness, lightheadedness, and sometimes even death. So yeah, you want to sift that out. Get rid of it. And think about this. Jesus told Peter, what did he tell him? In Luke 22, verse 31, and the Lord said, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat. Well, why is this? Well, during the sifting process, the women were deciding what to keep and what to get rid of. So think about what Satan is asking here. He still wants to take the role of Jesus Christ as judge. Let me be the one who decides who stays and who goes. You can be pretty sure what his decision would be. Oh, it's all bad. Get rid of it. But that's what Jesus is talking about, this sifting process. Barley harvest would take about 4 weeks, three and a half weeks, and then the wheat harvest would start to overlap. The wheat harvest begins. What happens? Again, we have a shift in the weather patterns. So now the winds, prevailing winds, have shifted, and they're coming out of the east. What's to the east of Israel? Hot, dry, desert. Once those winds shift, the rain stops. There's no more rain for 6 months. It's interesting when you look at 1 Samuel chapter 12, verses 16 and 18. Now, growing up here in the Midwest, And I read through this and thinking, yeah, so?
But what does it say here? Now that we know that during the wheat harvest, it stops raining. For 6 months, it stops raining. What does Samuel say here in 1 Samuel chapter 12, verses 16 and 18? Now therefore stand and see this great thing which the Lord will do before your eyes. Is today not the wheat harvest? I will call to the Lord and he will send thunder and rain that you may perceive and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord in asking a king for yourself. So Samuel called to the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day. And all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel, because they knew God can control the rain. And it doesn't rain during the wheat harvest. What a message. It wasn't just some ordinary shower because it doesn't rain. But in addition to it raining, it was thundering and lightning and stuff like that. They knew they had done wrong. The end of the harvest for the first fruits, for the grain, comes to a close about Pentecost. Now we get into the hot, dry days of summer. And there are a few minor fruits and things like dates and pomegranates and stuff that are harvested. But the next major harvest was the fruit harvest. That would begin in the fifth month, continue through the seventh month. And the two primary things are grapes and olives. The grapes for the wine and the olives for the oil. The harvest of those two things were by far the largest harvest that was made in Israel. The fruit harvest vastly exceeded the harvest of the first fruits of the grain. But what does it take to harvest grapes and to process them to wine? You know, it's not just a simple matter of, oh, pick, press, pack, we're done. No, the process for harvesting grapes includes a huge amount of time for preparation and then a short period of time for the actual harvest. So what kind of preparation did you have to do? Most of the vineyards were made up on the hillsides because the flat level things down in the valley, that was reserved for the grain fields. So in order to have your vineyards up on the hillsides, you had to build your vineyard. You had to create terraces so that the soil wouldn't erode away. And then the ground around the vines would have to be cleared of rocks. And they'd lightly plow the soil just so the moisture can get down to the roots of the grapevines. You'd build a protective hedge around your vineyard, A, to keep animals out that might sneak in and steal some of your fruit. But in addition to that, they would also build a watchtower. And of course, they'd have to maintain that because thieves would come in and steal the grapes. And sometimes the wine harvest, because it was so important, they would actually build temporary dwellings right there in the vineyard. So the family would stay there because once the harvest started, it was so important to get there and to get everything harvested very quickly. I'm not going to turn to these or even read them. We're running short on time, but you can see all this mentioned. I'm going to give you three references. Matthew 21, verse 33. Song of Solomon, chapter 2, verse 15. And then Isaiah, chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. It talks about
the wild animals, the hedges, the watchtower, the other things about here. But in addition to preparing the vineyard, you also had to prepare the vines. Because you had to work with the vines to make sure they have the best crop available. You'd have to put in the time to make sure the vines were in optimum conditions. That included removing dead branches to make room for the living vines. It required pruning the branches that were produced so that the plant's resources would go to producing grapes, not more leaves. And if the branch doesn't produce when it was expected, you had to prune that away too. Jesus referred to that in John chapter 15. So you prepare the vineyard, you prepare the vines, but you also have to prepare for the processing. Because see, once the grapes were ripe, the laborers had to pick them, and then they had to carry them to the wine press, which you also had to build and have available. The pressed juice was transferred into containers for storage and fermentation. They would then be stored in subterranean cisterns where the cooler ambient temperature of the subterranean room would allow the wine to store longer and have steadier fermentation. So, you had to have baskets to pick and carry the grapes. You had to have the wine press, and usually it was built in two levels. The stomping level, the upper one, is where you crush the grapes, and then the juice would flow down into the lower level where then you could collect that and put it into the storage units. Jesus talked about don't put new wine in old wineskins because the fermentation would create carbon dioxide. The old wineskins didn't have the flexibility, so it would burst. There goes your wine. New wineskins had that flexibility. But sometimes they also use earthen jars called amphorae. And they could, a lot of times they could store like 10 gallons or so. To tell you how important wine was for Israel, archaeologists had uncovered an underground storage facility near Gibeon that had the capacity to store 22,000 gallons of wine. That's how important the wine harvest, how large the wine harvest was. And finally, you get to the harvesting of the grapes. Keep in mind, it's still hot, still dry. Once those grapes start to ripen, if you don't get out there right away, get them picked, they're going to start rotting right there on the vine. There goes your wine. Matthew, again, we're not going to turn there, but Matthew chapter 20, verses 1 through 7, talks about the importance, how critical it is to harvest that fruit when it's ready. Talks about the vineyard master going into town repeatedly, hiring more people to bring them out, help me pick my grapes because it's got to be done. And we had similar things for harvesting the olives. You had to have the baskets, the pressing equipment, the storage containers, all that had to be ready. What we see here, as we gain a better understanding of what the fruit harvest process took, there are a couple important points we want to take away from this. The first is that the fruit harvest is by far the largest harvest of the year, which is a good analogy for what God is doing with humanity. Those who are being called first fruits are a smaller group of people. But for the second resurrection, all the rest of humanity, huge in comparison to the first fruits, is going to be resurrected and get an opportunity. Secondly, we see that the process used to gather in the harvest, especially for the fruit, requires a significant amount of time for preparation, which is then followed by a shorter but an intense period of time for gathering the fruit. This entire process foreshadows a time of great preparation which is pictured by the Feast of Tabernacles, the millennium. And stop and think about what's going to have to be made ready to prepare for the second resurrection. Housing, clothing, food, everything for billions of people who are going to be resurrected is going to need this long preparation time. And then you've got a relatively short period of time for when the fruit's going to be gathered. So these 8 days, Feast of Tabernacles and Last Great Day, look forward to a time when the vast majority of humanity, the ones who are not among the first fruits, will have the opportunity to become spirit beings and brought into the family of God. So today we've gone quickly. We've gone through an overview of various elements of the agricultural year, because the Bible does make numerous references to farming, and there's considerable symbolic meaning to the feasts, to parables, to the analogies that are used within the Bible's pages. We see in there that God's word is depicted as rainfall and as seed, and the church is referred to as first fruits. And there are a lot of other examples where we see agricultural references. So as we read and study the Bible, understanding the yearly farming cycle can give us further insights into understanding the things that we need to learn from these biblical examples as we're preparing the coming kingdom of God.